Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Monday. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I will share it with the people unless you don't want me to. And, of course, I won't do that. Coming up in the second hour of the show, the Dual Inspiration segment. Coming up, Bathsheba Smithen, co-host of that segment, lyricist, educator, recording artist, motivational speaker, checks back in. Talking about positive mindsets and how your mindset impacts your quality of life. It is a major specific correlation there, obviously. We will get into that conversation during the Dual Inspiration segment with Bathsheba Smithen up this evening. In the second hour also, we're going to open the phone lines. We're going to begin a discussion in the first hour about homicides and violence. And in from 6:05 to 6:28, we'll open the phone lines and talk about this past weekend, 14 shootings, I believe, 12 to 14. The city is scrambling for answers. I mean, I think not just officially from an official capacity, but also leaders in different communities are fighting hard to try to see what we can do to try to slow this violence down, because if we don't, we are going to finish the year with another record in homicides, more loss of life, and really unprecedented violence in our city's history. We're going to open the phone lines up at 6:05 to talk about how we begin or how we continue to fight this battle that we seem to be losing against violence and homicides in our city. That's going to happen at 6:05. During our first hour, that conversation that I talked about will be with Marvin Doc Cheatham, CEO of the Matthew Henson Community Development Corporation, civil rights advocate as well, talking about violence and, what has happened this past year and specifically how it has impacted the community that he serves in West Baltimore, primarily in Sandtown. But first, a discussion about court decisions against the Trump administration, more court decisions going against the Trump decisions. Later on in this segment, we'll talk to Ada White Pettit, veteran defense attorney and Washington Observer, about the Maryland and D.C. deciding to sue Trump over the emoluments clause of the Constitution. But first, before we get to Dwight Pettit, we go to our friend Kenneth Jost, our man on the Supreme Court. He is author of Supreme Court Yearbook and Supreme Court from A to Z, both by CQ Press. And he is also the author of the Jost on Justice blog. Kenneth Jost joins us again. Kenneth, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you, as always.
So let's get right to it. It seems like every week you and I are talking about another loss for this Trump White House, specifically connected to the travel ban. So this time it was the Ninth Circuit's shot at the Trump White House, deciding to hold up the ruling. I believe it was in Hawaii. It was a 3-0 ruling, I believe. It was a unanimous decision by the court's bench.
That's quite right. So the Ninth Circuit, hearing the government's appeal from the ruling in the Hawaii case that went against the government, the second ruling, the court in Hawaii ruled executive order number one was no good. Same court ruled the same way on executive order number two. Here, the Ninth Circuit, the appellate court for the Western United States, says, just as it did in the first case, executive order number two is still no good. And this is a simpler and a more straightforward decision than the one issued by the Fourth Circuit last week, which is at the Supreme Court right today. This opinion doesn't deal with the question of whether this is a Muslim ban, doesn't deal with the Establishment Clause issue, the religious discrimination issue, at all. This decision just says, straightforward, look, the immigration law says you can't discriminate on the basis of nationality, and that's what Executive Order Number 2 does. It discriminates against 180 million people in those six countries and says, you can't come in. And the president did not, didn't dot the I's and cross the T's to impose that kind of ban, even if it might be legal. He didn't make the kind of findings necessary that his order would be, that the entry of those people would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. And for good measure, this court says, and oh, by the way, he can't lower the number of refugees per year from 110,000 to 50,000. He can't do that just with the stroke of a pen. He's got to make some findings before lowering the cap for refugees, and he didn't do that either. So, wow. No constitutional issue, just a plain, plain vanilla statutory authority case, and that will make it easier for this Supreme Court than it would be with the constitutional issue added.
Well, Ken, there's a couple of questions before we let you go. First of all, is Trump seeking a Supreme Court review for this ruling as well?
Well, he certainly will. I mean, this ruling was issued at 10 o'clock, Eastern time, and surely the government will be asking, well, we want to stay the injunction that was issued way out west. The government has asked to stay the injunction that was issued by the Fourth Circuit, and today the plaintiffs in that case told the Supreme Court there's no basis for staying this injunction. Among other things, the executive order was a temporary ban for 90 days. It expires on Wednesday. So, why should you throw that injunction out?
All right. Final question, Ken. Is this? I mean, there is wide speculation and consensus in from many corners that this president is incompetent in some ways. But is this? Are these continue this series of defeats, specifically on the travel ban? Is this connected to Trump's incompetence or just the sheer incompetence of his legal team?
Yes to both.
Okay.
I'm at the Supreme Court where the lawyers from the Solicitor General's office come to represent the government. They're pretty smart people. They're pretty capable lawyers, but they've been handed a hard case to argue.
Hmm. Yet he continues to argue it.
Let me underline the decision from the Ninth Circuit has nothing about what Trump said during the campaign. So, the Fourth Circuit decision relied in part on, well, Trump said it was going to be a Muslim ban, and so it is. But the Ninth Circuit decision is just so much cleaner and will be so much harder for the government lawyers to try to undercut that decision.
Well, to be continued, of course. Kenneth Jost is author of Supreme Court Yearbook and Supreme Court from A to Z. He is also author of the Jost on Justice blog. Ken Jost is our man on the Supreme Court. Ken, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's make the transition from the Supreme Court to the attorney generals for the state of Maryland and Washington, D.C., both suing the Trump White House for violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. And for that, we turn to noted defense attorney A. Dwight Pettit. Dwight, welcome back to the show. Thank you, sir.
How are you doing, Sean? Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you, as always, Dwight. So these are anti-corruption clauses of the Constitution that Brian Frosch of Maryland and the Attorney General for Washington, D.C., Attorney General Carl A. Racine, both they say that the Trump White House they allege there has been, quote, unprecedented constitutional violations. Unprecedented constitutional violations. That's a serious charge given the history of constitutional violations that we have seen coming out of White House houses in the past.
Well, it raises some very, very interesting questions, Sean. The jurisdiction is based on the United States Code. 1331 is the provision which gives federal jurisdiction. This does come in a federal court. It's filed in the United States District Court here for the state of Maryland. And it raises some very interesting issues, especially when you get into the question of immunity and whether the president is immune from civil cases. Now, your audience should understand that what Maryland and what the District of Columbia are talking about is a civil remedy, not a criminal proceeding.
Okay.
And they're asking for injunctive relief. And what this will do, if granted, will give them the opportunity for discovery, which is a tremendous weapon in this point in time, because they would be able to ask for the tax returns, which the Congress has not been able to obtain, of Donald Trump. And that would give them, make it a whole new ballgame. But the question here is going to be, as I understand it and as I see it, whether or not the president has, because here's what they did, Sean, they sued him in his official capacity. Now, we have some authority and some law that the immunity is taken out if they sue him in an individual capacity.
Mm-hmm.
That was established in the Clinton versus Jones case back in 1997.
Okay.
You remember the young lady that sued Clinton,
right,
saying that he had sexually assaulted her.
Right.
So the court opened up the door for private affairs, and particularly private things that took place prior to the presidency. I think this action in terms of his official capacity is going to open up brand new arguments that I haven't seen entertained before. The interesting aspect about this, though, particularly what fascinates me, is to Maryland, even more so than the District of Columbia. Maryland is bringing the action almost implying a contractual relationship between Maryland as one of the original 13 colonies, that when they entered into the agreement in terms of joining the Union in terms of the Constitution, that part of that understanding would be that the President of the United States would act in a constitutional manner. And they, as Maryland as a state, not only is the citizens being injured, not only are the citizens of the nation being injured, but the state is being injured and damaged on a continual basis to have to, in fact, compete with foreign governments in terms of profits and business, as well as the domestic emolument clause, which says that the state should not have to compete with other states in terms of people who have given benefits to the president. So the long answer to your question that you open up, this is going to be fascinating litigation, Sean.
Wow. The state of Maryland is contending, among other things, that Donald Trump's conflicts, business conflicts, internationally specifically, if I'm reading you right, are just one part of that part of those conflicts that they outline are doing harm to the state of Maryland in their ability to do business, conduct commerce with other countries and other entities outside the United States.
Right. They quote such things as his hotel development. They quote such local things in terms of the casino development in Prince George's County.
Wow.
They cite other business arrangements and things that are being developed and taking place in the state of Maryland, which they argue and claim puts the state of Maryland at an economic disadvantage because the government obviously will show favoritism, and they go ahead and cite examples of what they believe is this example of favoritism, not only in terms of the Trump administration, in terms of the White House, but also various agencies of the Trump administration that will give favorable consideration to those persons who are spending money with the Trump enterprises, that they obviously will be looked upon more favorably, and Maryland has to compete with that. And so their argument, they go, as I look at the complaint, they go on, I think it's a 48-page complaint, Sean, and they lay out numerous businesses within the Trump empire, both nationally and locally, domestically, and to how that, in fact, disadvantages the state of Maryland, and since this is a joint suit, also disadvantages the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia pointing out the Trump Hotel there in the old post office building, how the post office building was not supposed to be leased to certain entities. When Trump becomes president, the General Services Administration waives that, and it goes through in particular all of these different things that will benefit the Trump industries and the Trump enterprises on a national and international basis to the detriment of the state of Maryland, the District of Columbia, the citizens of Maryland, and the citizens of the United States.
So the conflicts that have been cited so much throughout the first 100-some-odd days of this presidency, the state is saying, you're hurting our coffers. You're hurting our pockets as a state, basically. I mean, Trump is in the casino business, and therefore he may be receiving preferential treatment that could be to the detriment of the fiscal, the financial well-being of this state, which also relies on the gambling industry.
And across the board, his hotels, all of the, they cite in the pleadings all the different things that Mr. Trump has been involved in and was involved in before the presidency, his election to the presidency, and they continued to be involved in. And the fact that he was, in fact, advised, and they go ahead to cite Congressman Cummings and others who advised him that he was in violation of the emolument clause of the Constitution, both Article 1 and well as Article 2, and that he has ignored and continued to operate in an illegal and unconstitutional way. And that is almost, in my opinion, is obvious on his face, on its face. But as we know, the United States Congress has not acted in relationship to this, and by him being president, the Justice Department's not going to do anything. And the United States Congress, both the House of Representatives and the Senate, are both controlled at this point in time by the Republican majority.
Now, this is the
Republican leadership.
Right. This is the first time that this is the first time with the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia suing the Trump. This is the first time that a government entity has actually done so.
That's what makes it different, because you've had legal associations, you've had other businesses that have attempted to sue Trump and the Trump industries, and those basically those cases have been either knocked out or have been delayed or stopped based on his official and private immunity as president of the United States. And but this is, I see it, is the first time that legal entities and particularly, as I said before, particularly Maryland, which is a state and which was one of the original states to sign on to the Constitution of the United States. And as I gather from the pleadings, the implication almost seems to be contractual in nature. Wow. That, you know, Maryland recites this is the interesting thing about it, Maryland recites this clause, this emolument clause, in its own Declaration of Rights for the State of Maryland. So Maryland obviously considered this to be a major part of the United States Constitution and its adoption under the Constitution. And so that really raises a really new and very fascinating and interesting argument.
Well, it is fascinating, but I think the other piece of it that is incredible is that this may, I mean, whether or not the actual case is won or lost, however you want to characterize it, the possibility that this would force Trump to finally reveal details about his tax returns that have not been revealed to this point, that is another piece of it that is incredibly precarious for this 45th president.
Well, I think that might be an understatement, Sean. I think really that's the warhead of the missile.
Right.
To be able to seek discovery, if they can get past the immediate motion,
that's right.
To be able to bring him through subpoena and deposition, all of his financial records. That in itself would be the victory.
Absolutely true.
That the Congress has not been able to gain or take advantage of.
How ironic would it be if the state of Maryland would come through in the end and force Trump to do something that no other entity within United States government was able to do.
And what you might find interesting, Sean, and correct me if I'm wrong, I was just thinking about this, Brian Frost, our Attorney General,
right.
I think this is the legislation that he sought and got permission from the legislative body to, in fact, bring actions against the administration. Remember about a month ago, he asked the House, I mean, not the House, but the Maryland legislature to give him that legal authority.
The General Assembly. Right. I think you may be right about that. I have to go back and check. But I know I have a sense of what you're talking about. And it was for another case. Right.
Yeah, he wanted authority to be able, in terms of immigration and between the sanctuary issue, he wanted to be able to move on behalf of the state of Maryland against the administration, arguing that they were doing things that would be negative to the citizens of Maryland. Mm. And I think that went through, I know it went through the Maryland state legislature, and I'm not sure whether Governor Hogan vetoed it, or it overrode the veto, or just what happened. But I'm pretty sure that's where he went after the authority, and this probably was in the game plan all along, but nobody was aware of what his true intention was.
Interesting. Fascinating. A. Dwight Pettit is a noted defense attorney here in Maryland and also Washington Observer. Dwight, it's always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you so much for your insights. We appreciate you.
Thanks to be with you. Okay. Sean, talk to you later.
Yes, sir. All right. Bye-bye. Bye. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to open the phone lines. No, we're not going to open the phone lines. We're going to go to Marvin Doc Cheatham. He is the CEO of the Matthew Henson Community Development Corporation. We're going to be talking about violence in our city, homicides in our city that seem to be literally out of control, what the city's response to it has been, and what we can do differently. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Here on WEAA 88.9. 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo's, your host. We make the transition from the legal entanglements of the Trump White House to the entanglements on the streets of our city, unfortunately. Another epic weekend of violence and shootings. I believe 12 to 14 shootings over this past weekend. The homicide rate on pace to set another record, to go beyond that dubious record in 2015, the year of the uprising. In the studio with me is a man who knows these streets as well as anybody. He is Marvin Doc Cheatham. He's CEO of the Matthew Henson Community Development Corporation. Doc, good to see you in person, as always.
Honored to be here, and thanks so much for having me.
So I want to just say, I'm back in West Baltimore, and this past weekend, and really last weekend, it reminded me, I'm not exaggerating when I say this, and I don't say this with nothing but sadness, that the past two weekends reminded me of the days when I was in college and I would lifeguard during the summers, and I would come home to stay and work. And it sounded like, I mean, the drug wars, the wars over over drug turf, right at the beginning of the crack implosion, was like, it sounded like, I mean, it was constant machine gun fire and gunshot fire all night long. And that's what I grew up in the mid-80s.
Okay.
That's how it has sounded the past couple of weekends here in the city now. I haven't heard it like that for a long time. The helicopter, helicopters whizzing through the air, the gunshots. And honestly, it sounded almost like explosions. I don't know. I mean, you know, I know the difference between firecrackers and explosions.
Sad enough, Sean, we here, I'm in West Baltimore. We're in different portions of West Baltimore. Some call us Sandtown, some call us Winchester. Mm-hmm. We call ourselves Easterwood, but we hear gunshots almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
Folks are even questioning, you know, what size gun was it that they heard firing? Sometimes it almost seems like the TV program MASH, because we actually hear helicopters all day, every day. It is clear that we have significantly lost, not only in the fight against drugs, but even more so today, we have lost the fight here. And when I say we, I'm talking about the police, I'm talking about elected officials, I'm talking about the community, that all of us have a responsibility. But we have seriously lost in the fight in the last 3 to 4 years to reduce the violent crimes that we are having. Violent crimes are significantly going up. Thanks be to God that we have some of the greatest hospitals in the world right here in Baltimore.
Sure.
When we look at 150 homicides, has it not been for, and had it not been for some of the hospitals we have, you could very easily multiply that by three as to how many shootings. A shooting very seldom is aimed to just harm someone. Usually a shooting is actually to kill someone.
To kill, right.
You know, thank God many of these young guys, and we have to say young ladies as well, have not been trained in how to use weapons, because I think the number would be higher. We have discussed different issues that need to take place, and I'm putting out on the table a concept to bring a community crime reduction center, starting with West Baltimore. I know one would say, because he's from West Baltimore, why is he saying West Baltimore? And I'm saying, if you look at the data for at least the last 10 years, look at the violent crime, look at the homicides, look at the real crime and violence that's taking place. Usually it's the Western District, sometimes flipping coins with Southwest, sometimes Northwest. But we need to start somewhere, and we need to take a totally different approach. And I really want to thank and commend the young brother, Brandon Scott, a new councilman. I think he's the chair of the crime and violence type committee for the city council. And he said something today on another station and indicated very clearly, and he's the only one I've heard of any elected official currently to admit that we've actually lost in this battle.
And let's unpack that a minute. And before we're going to come back to maybe the specifics of the initiative that you proposed, Doc. But specifically what Brandon said, and he has, I think, to a great extent, risen on the council because of his positions on law enforcement. He has not been afraid to jump out and make statements and make proclamations whether people view them positively, negatively, whatever, I think that he has been bold enough to try to make assertions and make proclamations. But specifically, to your point, what did he say that really caught your ear today?
He said we have to try to do something different than what we've been doing. Evidently, we have not done well in addressing the violent crime and the increase that we are seeing today. And I think that's, you know, what we have to address. The mayor did come on a different station and indicated, you know, that they had brought in under her new administration some of the five different government agencies that deal with crime and violence. But I had a real problem with that because I remember so distinctly I am in the community of Freddie Gray, where we had 14 businesses hit, not three at North and Penn, but we had 14 businesses hit in my community, more than any community in the entire city of Baltimore. And it was very, very clear to me and to us that our elected officials really don't have a handle on what's going on, and we need to do something different. And one of those things that's different is we need a holistic approach. We don't need necessarily millions. We may, in fact, need billions of dollars coming from these governmental agencies that I've listed in my proposal, that their responsibility, their mission is to deal with crime and violence and health and housing in communities. And I'm happy to say the mayor did bring them in January, but the previous mayor brought them in August of 2015 when we had the Freddie Gray riots. And I would say if you look at the data from 2015 till today, there have been no significant improvements as a result of bringing in these governmental agencies, because to bring in two people from each governmental agency, what are they, Superman or Batman, and they're going to wave a wand and make miracles happen? No, we need major programming, major funding to address the problems we have. And there are a plethora of issues. Kids dropping out of school, not having GEDs, getting early drug arrests, basically having humanistic problems, but no one has addressed them. And we need to address in a holistic way how we can help these young men and young women, because the women are increasing in their crime and violence.
To what you allude to, Doc, the reality is, and this is no secret, over the last 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, we've seen money, budgets for those programs that you just outlined shrink.
Yes.
We've seen the budget for law enforcement, for the police department, get larger. But it doesn't seem to be
no positive result as a result of it. And I think that's because we really haven't sat down with some of those organizations and entities that could be of help. And we've listed some of those organizations that do this on a regular basis. You know, and I don't mind if you don't mind, I'll list a few of them. Mentoring Male Teens in the Hood.
We just had Cameron on the show.
Love the brother.
Day. Love him to death.
He should have $1 million project for the type of results that he has. James Moser Associates, the oldest continuous black little league in America. The 10-12 Sports Group. The 10-12 Sports Group is a group that many may not know. This is a football league. They take care of all these young guys. The Joel Gamble Foundation, the Center for Urban Families, the Fraternal Order of Ex-Offenders. All of the fraternities have male programs. There are just so many programs that are not receiving funding, but they're doing the work. They're doing the work day in and day out, but no one is giving them the kind of financial background or support to actually help us help ourselves. Black Mental Health Alliance. We have a mental health problem here in Baltimore that many don't want to admit to. But we also need to talk to the AFL-CIO, because we need to train these young brothers and sisters that have no talents, have no real abilities to do anything. We need to partner with our local unions, the masonries, the plumbers, the electricians, to teach our young people a skill so that they won't necessarily have to go back out in the street to make the money to take care of their families.
The issue of mental health, Doc, is one that we have talked about, touted over and over and over again on the show. The Black Mental Health Alliance, Jan Desperate Peters, she knows that they have an open door policy for our show, that whenever they want to come on, they can talk, and I support them no matter what they do, because that you are 100% right. The issue of mental health in our city is the 10,000-pound gorilla in the corner that nobody wants to talk about, but everybody's getting beat down by.
And it's every day, Sean. You know, I wake up in the morning. I built a park, thanks to the government and the state and the city. I built a park in our neighborhood to kind of change the mindset and get the community to start doing social positive things with each other. Get up early in the morning, go get myself something to eat, and the first thing I'm hearing is cussing and screaming in a store, just ordering a sandwich. Right. And it's from the beginning of the day to the end of the day. And it's not necessarily that we have bad people. It's that the upbringing of our children today has not done well by our parents who have brought them up. Grandparents basically raising kids because the mom and dad, for whatever reasons, have not done well. We need to really look at this. And I'm excited about just the mere fact that Brandon continues to reach out and say things that many may not have the chutzpah to say. But oftentimes it's going to take some of these millennial folks that see a different way, a different approach to address a problem. And we don't hurry to do this. I'm going to say probably by 2018, we're going to reach the point where we're going to be talking about 500 and 600 homicides because things are getting worse.
Well, so let's talk the fact that one of the things that if I'm reading you right and reading your email right, that Councilman Scott said was that he made the admission, I mean, at least from his capacity as a councilman, that we failed as a city. That
yes.
There's no more any way around it. That we failed as a city in the attempt to get violence under control. And with that admission gives us the opportunity to really start taking different actions, because obviously the actions that we're taking now have not been working. What would you do? Let me ask you this question about funding, Doc. We've said many times on this show, you've said it, everybody that I know who cares about our city says it, when it comes down to funding these organizations that have been doing this amazing work for years, decades, there is a chokehold, if you will,
okay,
on millions of dollars in our city that is directed to the same organizations, the same entities, the same individuals time and time again. And these other great organizations that do amazing work are choked out.
That's right.
From being able to receive the money that they desperately need. If you gave an organization, if you gave Cameron Miles, if you gave him $100,000, he deserves way more than that. But if you gave him $100,000, he could probably, I mean, he already does miracles.
That's right.
But if you just gave, it just is nonsensical, the fact that we don't see, that we don't have the insight. And this isn't to disparage any single individual, because we've been doing this for a long time.
Okay.
And we have not been able to break the nonprofit industrial complex's grip on the millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars that come into this city. What does it take in your mind to change, to redirect, if you will, how money is doled out in our city?
I think you have to call the names, not necessarily in a negative venue, but to call the names of the people that need to do the asking. We have two United States senators, Van Hollen and Cardin. We have at least two, if not three, congresspeople that represent a portion of Baltimore, Rupesberger, Sarbanes, and Cummings, that they need to be the ones to actually ask. I think we have to come to grips and make the statement that I think needs to be said. We have the worst homicide rate of any city in the United States.
We
when
do.
You look at our homicides and compare it to
per
our
capita.
Population.
Absolutely.
You know, we are it. And I haven't heard any, just like I've heard Brandon make the statement that we have failed. I have yet to hear an elected official right now say that that is the fact. And it is a fact. You know, our numbers basically substantiate the fact that we are doing that bad. I'm saying, and I think a number needs to be put out there, and I think the agencies that have some mission responsibility to deal with this issue, I'm saying it's an $11 million issue. I'm reaching out and saying these are some of the agencies, governmental agencies, that have responsibilities that deal with crime and housing, mental health. And it's the Secret Service, who has been here, the DEA, the ATF, the U.S. Marshals Service, the U.S. DOJ, the Department of Health, the Department of Education, Department of Housing and Urban Development, Homeland Security, U.S. Department of Labor, U.S. DOJ, and Veterans Affairs, because we most assuredly cannot leave out our veterans because we have done so for so long, and they too are experiencing awful tragedies, you know, because many of them have mental challenges. We need the Mental Health Alliance. Also, many of them have drug issues. So I'm saying this is at least $11 million issue. And I'm saying, as you said, what would happen if you gave 100 black men $100,000? What would happen if you gave 300 men $100,000? These groups that are doing it day in and day out, we know the names, but I have to call it like I see it. We know who gets the money, Johns Hopkins and all the offshoots from Johns Hopkins, and love a lot of the work that they do. But those that are on the ground every day that touch and feel and change the lives of our children are the ones that need to receive the funding, and they're not receiving the funding.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. I'm in the studio with Marvin Doc Cheatham, a longtime civil rights advocate and also CEO of the Matthew Henson CDC. Community Development Corporation. And what we're going to do at 6:05 is open up the phone lines and invite people into the conversation about violence in our city, homicides in our city. Doc Cheatham just made the statement, and I believe it's true, that Baltimore now is the number one jurisdiction for homicide, at least right now in 2017, per capita. Chicago obviously has more homicides, but Chicago also has more than 3 million people compared to Baltimore at a little over 600,000 people. We're at 150-plus homicides already this year, on pace to break that dubious, horrific record of 2015, the year of the uprising. We were talking about the shootings that we hear now on the weekends. It seems like this incessant gunfire. And assessing, I'm beginning to refer to Baltimore as Siren City, okay, because all we hear is
all day, all night long. That's right.
Sirens racing to and fro, and it just begs the question: we've got to do something. We've got to do something differently. I mean, we cannot advocate our community responsibility, of course, because that's not what we're talking about. But there are institutions and protocols and pathways that are well traveled, but they're winding up leading us to dead ends, unfortunately.
Well, one of the scary things, Sean, is not only the impact of families and relatives that have their family members lose their lives, lose limbs, but I look at it even further. The impact, the fact that I hear an ambulance 15, 20 minutes every day, 24 hours a day, we also have to look at those individuals that do the work. You know, what impact did this have on our firefighters? There are two jobs I could not do. I could not do a policeman's job, and I most assuredly can't do a fireman's job. I am not going into a house that is burning up. And for these firemen and firewomen that do such outstanding work, they too need to be looked at with reference to mental health. The fact that they are seeing this every day, and they too are saving lives right there on the ground. It's out of whack. It's out of kilter. And what we have done is not working. I know folks, I was on Facebook last year about this time and got shot down very well by quite a few, because I say, what do you call this other than a state of emergency? I don't know what else to call it. You can't call it a tsunami. You can't call it a tornado. Can't call it a hurricane. What label do you give it? And if you lose your loved one, maybe you would concur with me that it is a state of emergency. And we need to do something significantly different than what we're doing, because what we're doing has significantly failed.
Well, you make a really important point about our service providers, whether they be law enforcement or fire services. They are seeing and emergency services.
Yes.
They are seeing the I mean, we talk about the citizens of Baltimore being victims of post-traumatic stress disorder, right?
Right.
Because they day in and day out, we see here what we see and hear and deal with what we deal with. But you're right. The people on the front lines who are providing these services, emergency services, whether it be law enforcement, fire, ambulance, medical services, they are suffering day in and day out. And let's be clear. Some of the issues that we've seen as far as misconduct within in the Baltimore City Police Department, some of those issues are linked directly to mental health issues that, that maybe officers are not addressing or are not have not been addressed for various reasons.
Well, one, I think one of the challenges that many of us have, I'll start with myself, I have no expertise or no experience to really be able to listen very quickly and visually look at someone and get a quick impression that this person may have a mental health issue. But when you look at some of the professionals we have with the Black Mental Health Alliance, these folks are so professional.
Absolutely.
Just sitting with someone just a few minutes, they pick up so much so quickly. And I'm just saying that it's not just the crime and violence families, us experiencing what we're having, but it's just so many others of us that are working day to day providing services that are also experiencing this. I wonder how the doctors and nurses handle this every day. If you know every day you're going to go in, you're going to have five or six shootings coming to your hospital every day. Now, I know that's your job, but that has to weigh on you at some point. But we need to have a one-stop community service center that brings in our males and our females that are having these problems and do a holistic inventory of their challenges, their problems. And we need to do this yesterday. One of the things I also heard Councilman Scott say on another station was that, you know, oftentimes we talk about, you know, what needs to be done, but it seems like we're not getting it done. And I'm saying, you know, what is it that has to happen? Do we have to lose 100 people in one day for us to say this is an emergency of some sort? We need to do something. And I know one thing he did say, and I shut down with this. He indicated that in the month of May, they were discussing, because he had asked, what is the plan to deal with the escalation of violent crime? And they were just talking about it in May and hoping to implement it in July. And he had a real problem with that. How can you expect in 2 months to create a plan to deal with the violence and crime? And you're only giving yourselves 2 months to even implement it.
I mean, it is exacerbating. There's no doubt about it. But, I mean, the point is, at what point do we stop going in circles and begin to I don't know. Some people may take offense to the language that you used when you were on Facebook about a state of emergency. But, I mean, I don't know what to call it. I know that it's not normal. That I do know. And to suggest that it is, it is a searing indictment of our city. We can't. I keep going back to this, to the notion or the fact that Baltimoreans are some of the most resilient people that in the world, really. But that's a dual-edged sword, because when we're super resilient, we tend to believe that we can take anything, but yeah, we can't take anything because we're human.
That's right.
And until we come to grips with that fact that we aren't that maybe we shouldn't, maybe we should acquiesce as far as or be more conscious of the fact that we should not be forced to take anything, because it seems like we're being forced to take anything. To the peril of the vast majority of our citizens, most of them poor and most of them Black.
I agree. And there are so many different ways to approach it: education, health, mental health, just some real fundamental things. I think our recreation and parks has significantly failed us. I was very excited this past Saturday. I coached Little League baseball, believe it or not. And we went to the field on Stricker Street across from the Lillian Jones Rec Center. And much to my amazement, but much to my delight, I'm seeing almost 100 young guys playing football, these 13, 14, 15-year-olds. It excited me to see that here it is, even in a makeshift field, because the city has not seen the necessity to really build good fields for us, that these guys were actually out there playing. And I know if they weren't on Stricker Street, the 1300 block, two blocks down the street, probably the 1100 block, they could very easily sell drugs and make a quick dollar just two blocks down the street. And we had to, of course, go down to another place to practice. But I'm saying we have failed in just so many areas. You know, football right now is the most popular sport for our community. But most of our football fields are not of the quality, have not been kept up. Yeah. We need more basketball courts. We really don't have baseball fields, even though baseball is a dying breed to some extent. But how do you play baseball or practice baseball when the grass is 8, 10, 14 inches high? And you know, I put that on Bureau of Recreation and Parks. Some of our recreation centers, and I'm called mine, you know, I like to call my own so I don't call somebody else's. But I have to say, thank God for Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated, Pi Omega Chapter, for taking over the Easterwood Rec Center. But I have to say, because of the neglect of Baltimore City and the Bureau of Recreation and Parks, we have the worst equipped rec center in the city of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Carver High School has the worst football field in the city of Baltimore. And all this is in the Western District.
Well, I would say Carver is, if Carver's is the worst, what used to be Walbrook's is right behind it, because it's not.
It ain't far.
It's not it far ain't behind far. My alma mater, unfortunately. Doc, what we're going to do is we're going to, after we come back from a break, is open the phone lines and take some callers. Will you stick with us for a little while?
I'd be happy to. I even take a couple more lumps upside the head about the issue of state of emergency or whatever it is we're going to call it. But well, we got to get out of this funk that we're in right now.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break when we come back, the second hour, first edition, and we will open the phone lines, 410-319-8888. We're going to continue this conversation about violence, homicide in our city, and what is the appropriate response of our city, not just from the political side, but from the community side, from the activism side, from the grassroots side. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.